Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Fucture, the podcast that speaks to the innovators of today, who, of course, are making the future happen. And making the future happen with me this week is Third Magazine Editor-in-Chief, Rona Izuma. Now, Rona, have I got the magazine name right? Is it Third?
Yes, that's exactly it. We just have three eyes.
Wow. Was there a particular reason for putting those three in? Because I had many theories about why you did it.
Yeah, we kind of really grappled over the name, as I guess you do when you're creating anything that you really care about. And the idea of having a third eye really connected to us, as many of the conversations we were having about what we were doing and what we were saying reflected this idea of digging deep and going beyond the surface. We are a fashion, arts and culture publication, but we've always said that our aim is to bridge the gap and to connect culture, the arts and all the things we love to things that we are informed by, like intersectional feminism, what we're calling today decolonial thought, but back then was called like sort of like post-colonial thinking and just real matters. That was like the first nudge for us. But I think we at that point, we still had other ideas. And what really sold it for us was me remembering this concept of third space, which I learned about in uni. It's a concept by the theorist Homi K. Bahaba. And he describes the third space as like this liminal transformative space where juxtaposing ideas and identifications can meet, collide and create new and exciting things that are like less hierarchical. They're supposed to be spaces where the oppressed can meet to devise plans for emancipation. So remembering this second connection, I really started to say to the group, like, yeah, okay, we should be called Third.
I'm guessing there's a third one because you've done it in twos, and I'm guessing there's a third one coming up. Or my theory is incorrect about how three is such a mystical, magical, beautiful number.
No, you're on the money, actually. From there, we actually came across the idea of being third cultured or being a third culture kid. And that's a term that people refer to explain the fact that people have like a cultural heritage that usually comes from their parents. They have another culture, which comes from the places that they grew up in and the places that they live. And then the third culture is supposed to be like this messy amalgamation of all of that. And I think at the point that we found out about being third cultured, we were like, shut the front door. This is literally us. This is what we're trying to bring to the foreground and explore and represent with our platform. So that level of intersectionality was really what warranted another eye.
Wow. And of course, in Eastern mysticism and mythology, the third eye was the eye that opened up to consciousness and allowed you to see and experience other worlds, other realms. And I love the idea of the notion of a third culture, because in some ways I look at Britain and I think it's a huge product of third culture thinking. I always think that sense of how change, diversity, how, as somebody said, the blending of so many different references emerges. And yet that seemed to be the thing, or is the thing rather, I'm going to put it into the present tense, that people still have an opposition to. When I came across the title of your magazine, this is why I was asking you, I ran to a drag king friend who was actually just around from my office at the Glory, which we were, I think, talking about before we came on air. And, you know, they were saying about diversity and their partner kept talking about diversity. And the drag king was saying, look, you don't talk about it. You know, you do it, you show it, you be it. So interesting, I wrote that in three as well, that the kind of cadence and the beat. And they said, here's a magazine and a platform, and you appeared on my WhatsApp. And I think you sent me an email 2 days later. So again, there was that sense of serendipity and timeliness and a moment where we were both thinking about similar experiences about this notion of diversity and otherness. And then your third magazine appeared, and I was having a similar debate with the team here in the office about how we move things forward from the current tropes and standards in conversation.
Yeah. Firstly, I just want to say that's such a lovely thing to hear, because that's exactly why we have our platform. So comments like that really make me feel proud. We want to be that space where people can say, look, this is what you go to if you want to talk about diversity and inclusivity. And also just to retweet everything you were saying about Britain and our culture in some ways, actually being made from so many different cultural strands. But unfortunately, sometimes there is this resistance to credit that as part of what Britishness is actually all about. But I would also say she was right. The point that she made about doing stuff is so key. I think there are definitely stages that will come with creating anything important, and frustration might be the first one. It certainly was for us. There wasn't anything like us at the time we started our platform. Fashion magazines didn't really champion people from underrepresented backgrounds. We were more like box fillers for them. So that's really what galvanized us, and it still does. So what I would say, however, is if you can make your frustrations part of the reasons you're making change happen, then they go from frustrations to causes. And causes are really what create change. It's also really important to state that creating change is not easy. I'm the editor of an independent publication that sets out to do that, and I can confirm it. People shouldn't be blamed for not knowing how to change things because we are all still working it out. However, everyone has a choice and power when it comes to how you approach things, and everyone has a role. So maybe you're not the person who thinks up the thing that is creating the change, but maybe you've chosen to work, support, shout out about, learn from, and ultimately give to that space that is doing the work. And kind of take yourself away from the things that you're no longer enjoying as well. That's an important part of that process too. We have three pillars, our third, that really determine what we say we enjoy and what we say we want to create. And those are representation, inclusivity, and critical celebration. And when it comes to representation, diversity for us has always been linked to centralizing people whose stories and power is typically marginalized. Working from an intersectional feminist space, we knew those people would not only be Black people or people of color or trans people or women or queer folk or people who have a disability, it would be all of us. And so moving in a way that was inclusive has always been at our core, and showcasing how multifaceted and beautiful and interesting and inspiring we all are has been key. But that's not without reflecting on the struggle that exists and has existed.
I mean, it was interesting as I was kind of thinking about what you were saying, you know, the notion of critical celebration. When I was going through the platform and I managed to get a copy of one of the print editions, and what occurred to me as somebody who has worked in publishing and also as probably, you won't believe my age, but in 1986, I was one of the first gay journalists working on a gay London newspaper. And it struck me as being quite miserable because it was about AIDS. The paper was, of course, in black and white anyway, because colour printing was quite expensive and it was all done cheaply. Although it was called Capital Gay, it never to me looked like it was happy. And I remember there's a period about, you know, coming to terms with trying to explain to people who or what you are, which is hugely difficult and traumatic. And what I liked in contrast, looking at your magazine and looking at the platform, was how much energy and beauty and positivity was built into it. So it wasn't shying its back on the critical side. It was asking really essential and crucial questions, but it was doing so from a point of view of change can be brought about. Optimism doesn't have to sit always on the side of the people who are winning. And more fascinatingly, it really reminded me about when we talk about culture, the notion of culture is multifaceted. It's very difficult to be cultural in a monochrome world in the sense that, you know, everything is the same. And that was the thing I was going, wow. And I was thinking about, you know, my kind of, I always think of the 80s as being monochrome and dark, and it was like underbelly and clubs dripping with sweat and everybody feeling slightly put upon. And I go, wow, this is like, I wish I was born again and coming through in a different period. Was that something that you were actively considering when you were building? Because I know as an editor, you've got to really build this world. Is it in your liking, or are you reflecting what's happening around you? And if so, how do you ensure that you don't fall into that thing where it just becomes, a me and them? Because I felt it was absolutely trying to include everybody who perhaps felt left out at some point in their life.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. For me, it's an openness and almost trying to be direct about the situation we're in, but making it clear that everyone can participate. really that's the way you make change happen in general anyway, right? If you look at something like the civil rights movement, a core group of Black people in America decided that they were going to fight for their rights. And they were joined by other people who didn't come from that background. They were joined by white people, brown people, everyone. And so really what you want is social consciousness to change. And I think what is really interesting is that when you get to this place of social consciousness changing, that is when things slowly do start to actually really change. And I think sometimes I recognize that I'm a bit of an optimist. I am a Sagittarius myself.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm a Scorpio, so it's kind of positive negativism, I think, is a Scorpion, positive negativism.
That's part of my tropes, but I guess I always say feminism, though we are not a woman's magazine at all, but feminism in its truest sense was one of the biggest enlightenments for our platform. And if you look at intersectional feminism, what it fights for, it's always showing you that there are multiple struggles that are happening. And really the way forward is to deal with all of those things at once, but to get other people to acknowledge that there are times where different people's voices matter more. And marginalized voices in our publication are always going to be the ones that are at the forefront because they're the ones that are the most
not heard.
You know, exactly, in wider society. So it's having that openness, but also being direct about what you're trying to achieve, I think.
I mean, do you find it odd that we talk about intersectionality? And to me, it's a term that absolutely describes the nature of how the future needs to work. It's like a term that almost, you're amazed that it has been so debated and discussed and put into inverted commas, et cetera, et cetera. So hang on a minute. Everything is so complex that it's touched by something. And by that mere moment of something being touched, both sides are changed or multiple sides are changed. And I like the idea that there cannot be anybody surely in this world who is born and they are imagining that it's going to be like this forever. You know, that's it. And the notion of stasis in nature is such an unknown concept. You know, the notion that nature is simple is such an unknown concept. So I'm wondering why, when we talk about people who don't fit this linear, singular, in my way, rather dull view of what people should be, that we find ourselves getting so angry about it, rather than imagining, surely, in the distant future, or the not-so-distant future, when all of the various things we have stopping us fall away, we will become other. All of us will become other. We won't have to have this stupid debate about male, female, trans, non, whatever. You know, what's your thoughts on that, when you're kind of thinking about your next issues or your future issues?
Yeah, I think, you know, as human beings, we all hold on to delusions. And definitely one of the delusions that a lot of people hold quite closely to them is this idea that humanity has always been the same. And like we are definitely a continuation of what's come before us, but that we are sticking to strict models of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a Black person, you know? And people feel so contained by these definers. And I think part of that does come from a place of fear and a place of needing to hone yourself into something, that you become rejectional, like you just oppose anything that is different to what you feel that you know, instead of embracing the idea that we are all changing, we all morph. The whole purpose of our lives and being on this planet for however long we are here is that we develop and that we grow. And that's something that happens from childhood to adulthood. So why wouldn't that also expand into the future in the way that we understand these categories, these fictional categories like gender, like race, et cetera, et cetera. At the moment, they're designed for purposes to help us understand the world around us. But if the world around us is changing, then those categories also, in due time, need to change. But it can be hard learning new information. Like, I think, you know, everyone has some resistance sometimes to,
oh my
to
God,
new things that sometimes that come along.
It's shocking. I have to say it's shocking because, you know, that kind of Alice in Wonderland idea that you wake up each day to learn six impossible things. And I feel that it should be our duty. We should be absolutely made sign a contract saying you must wake up every day learning something new. I mean, I can only imagine. It's like I was born with a red sweater. Well, I'm going to wear this for the rest of my life.
Exactly.
We really wouldn't imagine that. And I just find it odd and strange. It irritates me. I will have fights with people when I hear them saying, you know, well, you know, the past was always better. And I go, really? The past has never been better than the now. And certainly we can make the future better. And that was the other thing I felt. Maybe because you're a creative director, maybe because you're coming out for, you know, entrepreneur, stylist. I also quite like the notion of how you were trying to create visual sensibilities and references of how things could look different or how they could be different. I mean, is that something you do deliberately, or is this just your day-to-day experience? You go, well, this is how the world is to Rona. And actually, I'm amazed other people don't see these things in it.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it is me reflecting on the things I see around me that I just don't think are given the honor in the same way other things are. But I also think, just to go back to what you said about learning, like that's also such a huge part of it as well. And I think that's one of the things that keeps people stagnant and keeps people afraid, because they're afraid of learning new things.
Yeah.
The new is always unknown, right? You have to get to know it. So it can feel a bit easier sometimes to just stick to what you already know. But I think growing up, I always kind of saw myself as a bit of an outsider, definitely more an outsider than an insider. And I think that feeling, it may have came because in wider culture, I didn't really see myself reflected, or I don't know where that feeling's come from. But I do think that because of that feeling, I've always had a curiosity, or brought a curiosity to everything else that has been perceived as other around me. And I think with curiosity, and especially something like empathy, I think empathy for me, actually, if I just focus on myself, it's a space that I create a lot of things from. I want to know. I want to understand. It's not that I feel like I do know all the time and I have all the answers. It's more like there's a question and I'm looking for many different voices to help me find answers to those questions. I'm also very conscious about seeing, especially what we do with Third, it's really the work of groups of people. It's never just the work of myself or even the team. It's always about groups of people and our contributors and our cover stars and all the people that we have included in what we do definitely come into that. And just within that, you know, there's so much diversity there. And I guess that's what helps us produce the platform and the content that we do produce, because we are open to that and we're inviting of that.
And I guess as you're describing that, one of the things we looked at on LSN, which is our online Foresight platform, is this notion of collectivism, collectivist thinking. And I guess it's all like federated decision making, where, you know, you have these collaborations, you have this sense of engagement, you have the sense of curiosity, and then you, it's not crowdsourcing, which is slightly the wrong term, but you're pulling together an idea that sits like a stew, and then you cook it up into this great feast and this great moment. And I always think those things require certain skills. I don't have them. I tend to be of the school where, okay, we've all agreed on this now, can we do it? Which I get told off about all the time, versus the creative team here, they will sit and have the chat that you're having and they turn out this great, beautiful work. Is it something we can learn? Because I think collaboration and collectivist thinking is now very much of the moment and coming into its own in a different way. Can I learn that? Or am I forever going to be some old chap that sits there whinging and telling people to do stuff and everybody goes, well, Martin, we're only going to do it. We need to talk about it first. Or is there a hope for me to learn how to be more collaborative?
Of course. Of course. Collectivism is only an approach. I think what I'm hearing you say is almost like, I'm the sort of person who, when I know what I want to do, I want to get things done. And I think that sense of impatience, that's a good use of impatience. You know, it's like you're a doer. You'll make the things happen. However, in that same model, there's definitely the space to bring people together, like decide things together and make that part of your process. And it seems like you're being quite harsh on yourself, to be honest with you, because
your I'm team always harsh. I'm Irish. The Irish are always harsh on themselves, mainly because other people are harsh on us first.
But it's having that awareness that, you know, your voice isn't the only one that matters, especially when you're doing something that is not about you, you know, it's for other people. your voice can't be the only one that matters. And I think as long as you have that, then that's a great start.
I mean, how, you know, with your thinking and with the way you approach things, I kind of wonder, you know, as an entrepreneur, you've described in some ways how myself and my partner set up the business. It was teasing our way into the future. You know, it was, we did a magazine and then it became an event and then it became a business. And kind of, it was almost like learning entrepreneurialism as I went. But in some ways, I was quite privileged, you know, although I'm, you know, an Irish vegetarian, slightly crabby, dyslexic, I still had advantages. But, you know, if I think about you, you are, you know, a Black person working in a pretty cutthroat industry. If I think about fashion, which is my background as well, branding, music, media, you're female as well. So it's another thing that sits, as we know, the percentage of women who manage to get loans from VCs is way, way, way lower than a guy who applies for the same thing. So were there things in your way on your journey, or have you not noticed that because you were just getting on with the journey?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Initially, it was a challenge even recognizing that there were walls around me.
Right.
In terms of being an entrepreneur, recognizing myself as an entrepreneur took time because there was a lot of resistance and imposter syndrome there. And actually, that wasn't my initial call to action. My call to action was change. Even today, I tend to call myself a founder because my way of approaching business has always been about responsibility and sustainability rather than classical business in the way I'd been brought up to understand it. So it's taken a while for me to like embrace the fact that I am an entrepreneur. I am someone who's creating something, making things happen and founding a business as well. And then I think in regards to being Black and a female, I've always been proud to be those things. So even when I've been angry about how they've boxed me in, I've never accepted this idea that it was going to hold me back. And this wasn't because I didn't know, you know, like I had a mum who would tell me, as many POC parents do, you're going to have to work twice as hard. But I was like, I don't want to do that. That doesn't sound fun. I'll work as hard as everyone else, please. You know, I'm good enough. But when you go into spaces and you realize that no matter how hard you work, you almost have this dual fight of almost trying to firstly, improve yourself. So to get better within yourself, but also to prove yourself to people, to make people see that what you're doing is of value. That was a challenge I didn't actually recognize would be as much as it was. But sustaining myself through it has really been about like being happy to be the person who's bashing through those walls and showing that because I know I have value and what we are doing is deserving, maybe it will take me longer, but I'm still going to get there because what I do, I believe, is of value.
Do you think that has been informed by what you have learned doing it or from your kind of background? I mean, did you go to business college fashion or what were some of the founding principles or areas that you felt, wow, I'm glad I did that because it's really helped me move forward?
Actually, so my background is obviously I work as a fashion stylist. So that's my career choice. It's my passion as well. And I do this because I grew up reading magazines. I always loved them. I thought I might be a journalist at one stage. And actually, I studied English literature. I did loads of journalism growing up. And so I have that sort of writing background as well. So the writing and the fashion were sort of my fortes. But the business, like, was something I had no experience with whatsoever. And so that was the thing I had to seek out knowledge for, and to trying to learn and understand. And I think this is maybe one of the challenges comes from in being like a Black woman is sometimes you want role models who are, you can look to and can say, have done this before you. And I think with me, there didn't feel like there were vast amounts of people I could turn to and could be like, I'm doing this. Can you show me how to do this? And that was scary at first, like super scary. Like I said, I was like, I'm a creative. I'm someone who cares about producing good work, who cares about ideas. I'm not someone who does spreadsheets and analysis and all these other things that I thought were very different to me.
And you think about it, I always think it's like a sentence. There's adjectives and facts, and great sentences need both.
Mm.
We produced a magazine, which was probably probably even now, it was £95 a copy. We did 2 copies per year, was full color, printed in Germany, everybody working for nothing as usual, because by the time you paid for the printing, there was no money left to pay, you know, apart from basic things. And what it taught me, I guess, is that you learn then about the principles of business, because it's about collaboration, to your point, persuasion, vision, having a sense of where you need to get to so you can show others the pathway or the possibility. And then also to pull a story or a narrative or a moment together that will affect people in a hopefully good way. Or in our case, it was about ideas. So we always wanted to change people's minds. And I think, to me, that's business. And as soon as you then start thinking about business as spreadsheets and numbers and measure, you absolutely murder the whole principle of why you wake up in the morning. And I always think that, you know, with the Future Laboratory, which is why I was keen to get you involved in the judging of our Future 100 innovators, is these are the people that are setting out to change the world. Now that you are there changing it, what kind of advice do you think you could give to them now that you've experienced these things, now that you've kind of done that road to where you are? Are there specific things that you go, wow, do you know what? If I could tell you this, it would save you a lot of hassle.
I think if you asked me on a different day, I could say something completely different. But right now, it's invest in your community. I think with us, you know, we've always had so much support, whether that's been support coming from collaborators and contributors, or support that's coming from audience and like people who have bought the magazine, come to our parties, come to our events. But we didn't always have the framework to be able to like make sure they stayed in touch, make them a part of like what we were doing continuously with Third. And I think it's ironic because our first issue because of that was called Community. So we were always thinking about community, but we were just never thinking about the other frameworks around it. We were just like buzzed to have community. And I think if we had done some of those things quicker, it would have been more beneficial for us and beneficial for a lot of the people who we've seen come through our ranks. Do you know what I mean? And who have supported us through the years. And sometimes, you know, people would ask us, people would say things like, oh, do you have a subscription model yet? Do you have this? Do you have that? And like, these things do take time. They really do take time. But I think don't be afraid to invest in those pathways from the beginning.
That's exactly the advice I was given. Not dissimilar. And actually, again, weirdly, probably because we've come along similar routes in terms of magazines, fashion, working in the creative industries. They said, never see what you're doing as transactional. You know, that's what happens when you go to a store. This is what used to happen. And she said, never see it other than a great conversation. And she said, if you see that it's a great conversation, it will open up a community. And she said, through community, you will see opportunity. And that opportunity will benefit a lot of people. And it took us probably as a business 10 years to understand that that point about the community does take you into different worlds, and it allows for people to participate and, I guess, to freely involve themselves in what the future could look like. And that, I guess, leads me to my question, which I ask everybody at this point, is we're jumping into a time machine. Okay, we're pulling the lever, spirals coming up in front of us, we're seeing the past recede, and we're being blasted into this great blur of future beauty and opportunity and stellar explosion. And then we stop the machine, and I'm with Rhona, and you're looking at this landscape that is now Third magazine, but it's your 38th issue. I'm trying to calculate now, about 2030 maybe, because you've been producing more issues a year. What are you seeing? What sort of things are you seeing in this world?
Wow, that's a good question. I see a lot of glass, really. I feel like I'm in a tall building for sure. I definitely saw a tall building. I also see blue skies. That was a very hopeful presentation. And I think I connect the blue sky with a lot of hope and sunshine. So I think I'm seeing those things. I know I'm seeing, in terms of our team, I'm seeing a bigger team, a slightly bigger team, working together, connected in a space, sharing a space, collaborating, sharing ideas. And I see energy around me and buzz, I think, for sure.
Wow. And so the kind of debates we're having now about, you know, gender, about sexuality, about culture wars and this war and that war, are we still having them, or have we reached some consensus and agreement and are moving forward, or is there just something else that's got to come around and stop us from getting on with living?
I really do hope that those conversations have moved forward so much more. I always love to reflect and think to myself, you know, I'm not naive enough to believe that things will be solved, because I always think about, you know, people who I credit as being the great thinkers and writers who have informed me. And they were writing in like the 80s and the 70s and stuff like that. And so much of what they're saying is still relevant now. We've just moved the conversation forward. I hope for sure people are using people's pronouns. We have structures in place for dealing with racism and structural racism and unconscious bias. Like, it's not an escape word, basically. But I still think we will still be dealing with other things at the same time. I still think we'll be dealing with other things.
Do you find the pronoun thing annoying? I was chatting to this woman the other day. She said, look, you know, if I said to you, what's your name? You said, it's Martin. She said, well, I'm going to call you Tom. She said, how stupid that would be. And she said, the same thing with a pronoun. If you say to them, what's your pronoun? And you say, I'm she or they. Well, I'm not going to call you that. She said, how stupid that seems. And I just thought, in some ways, we really need to get back to basics, remind people that potentially the future is about not just great manners, but listening to people. And if they say, actually, this is what I would like to be and how I'd like to be represented, why spend so much time debating it? There must be better things to do.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that 100%. I think so much of life is about habit, right? So that resistance comes from a place of you have certain habits, you don't want to give them up. Some habits need to be replaced.
Yeah, come on.
If you smoke, I'm sure you're trying to stop smoking, maybe, who knows?
Yeah.
And so don't make up ideas around why you shouldn't try, you know?
Because I guess that's my thing about the future is I try to put myself in a position where I always ask a question or challenge an assumption I have. Or better still, and probably, Ronnie, you do this as well, where you just find somebody, I'm going to annoy them. I'm going to find somebody who's so kind of backward looking. I'm going to spend the next 20 minutes. That's my great idea of fun, to really tease them out. There's a great art expression, teasing. You know, you tease somebody out where you're really testing them to see, do they really believe that or they haven't really thought about it? That's the kind of thing I often worry about the future, is that the resistance isn't there because we willfully believe it. It's there because we haven't really thought about the alternatives.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think so many people are still resistive to doing the thinking because they don't think it concerns them, but they have such strong opinions about things. I always find it quite funny, especially when it comes to things around trans rights. You find everyone's an expert who isn't trans. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, even on panel talks, like, everyone's giving their opinion except from the trans person who wasn't invited or the trans person who's been made to defend their existence.
Yeah.
I don't understand how people can't understand that as backwards anyway. So hopefully we're able to move away from putting people through that needs to explain themselves.
You know, if you think about the science, we're, you know, experienced one of the great leap forwards in science in terms of where we, you know, even things like Alzheimer's, we will be able to tackle these issues. And I go, you know, the other issues is where we choose our pathway and we choose our life. And nobody should object to that. So why are these debates happening? And it's kind of a thing that I think that book I've interviewed was a similar point she was making about how, if I am self-determining and you are self-determining, why does your self-determination require less proof than mine? You know, why is it that I'm always having to be on trial and you're always having to sit on the higher ground? I thought, wow, okay. So that was my other thing about the future, is that I want those debates to be gone. But there's one thing, because I know we're just running out of time, and I did think about this. I was thinking, oh my gosh, you probably, like me, because we produced even that great digital transition where you're moving into, you know, virtual, digital. we produced at this magazine twice a year. You know, that love of print, tactility. And I noticed that despite the success of your platform, you still hanker, and you're probably still doing it. I think you've got, have you got another issue, a print issue of Third planned? Is there one coming out?
Well, we've just actually released one, issue 6, Body Movements. Very happy it's out. Print is our baby, you know, it's our core, and it's also our commitment. And it always feels like such a celebratory moment having a new issue out.
You see it. It is like giving birth. Because I always think when I publish something online, it feels relentless. Oh my God, we've got to do it again and again and again. And when I see this magazine, we used to sit, and I guess you will do this, when those first issues arrived in the office, you unbox them and you sit there just looking at them and touching them and going through them. And I don't know if you do what I used to do, which is smell, because we always had that great...
Paper smell,
yeah. Mm. I don't know. And these are the things that I fear. And what I found interesting is I just finished reading a survey which said that Gen Alpha, one of the things they're still keen on is the beauty and solidity and permanence, I think was another word used, of print. I mean, is that how you feel about it? Or is it your secret craving is that I want to have, you know, a nice run of magazines behind me? They're mine.
No, totally. First off, a magazine is a tactile object. It's something you can flick through. It's contained. You can read it. It's more like a book to me. You know, I've always approached our magazines as collections. So almost like book collections. And also, I feel like magazines are quite self-actualizing. Like they're things you keep in your spaces. They're things that you return to, that you reference, and you have close to you. As much as I love the work that we do online, it doesn't exist in the same way. So for us, print will always be part of what we represent. We're a magazine and that's always going to be
perfect. I'm so looking forward to issue 28, I think will be the next time we should chat.
Me too. We'll have a big party then.
Can you just remind us the web address of your platform so that people who are listening can go and check it out for themselves?
Yes, we are www.third3eyes.com. magazine.co.uk.
Okay, perfect. And I guess the print version will be available at all good, I was going to say most good bookshops, but all good bookshops.
Yeah, all good bookshops and online from us.
Perfect. Rona, many thanks for talking to me. It's Rona and Martin here having a chat, reminding you, as always, to keep looking. And I think from the heart here, because it's a magazine, keep reading, keep listening, keep learning, and always, always, always keep asking what's new and what's next.